Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Betsy DeVos is making her mark and following through on President Donald Trump's campaign promises. Last week, she rolled back protections for students caught up in for-profit school fraud. She wants to scale back protections for gay and transgender students in public schools. And she's pushing hard for charter schools and vouchers. This hour on Point, Betsy DeVos and her vision for public education. You can join us on air or online. Are you on board with Secretary DeVos? Is she what America's students need? Or is she decimating public schools? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from Washington this hour, Molly Hensley Clancy from BuzzFeed News. She covers the intersection of education and business, and you can link to her reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Molly, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. Thanks
so,
for having me.
Thank you. Betsy DeVos has made some big moves in education the last few days. Help us understand what's happening at the Department of Education.
Yeah, sure. So last week, we got news that the Department of Education was making its first big moves in higher education, and they're doing that by rolling back these two key regulations that the Obama administration passed. One of them allows students who have been defrauded by their colleges, and a lot of those are for-profit college students, to have their loans forgiven more easily, and it also puts in place some protections for for-profit college students. And the other is a regulation called gainful employment. The Obama administration worked for years to get this passed. And what gainful employment does is it punishes for-profit colleges where students take on too much debt and don't earn enough money, and also some community colleges, but again, mostly for-profit college students. And that's meant to stop federal money from going to these schools that don't perform well.
All right, a lot there in just those two rollbacks.
Yeah.
Start with the gainful employment mandate. As you said, this is college students who take on too much debt, earn too little after graduation. Give us an example to help us understand what that means for the average student.
Yeah, sure. Well, so basically, there's this classic example of this for-profit college chain called Corinthian Colleges. They got billions of dollars in federal money through student loans, and there was essentially no way to stop that money from flowing to this school. It eventually collapsed. Tens of thousands of students were left without, you know, in debt. And this rule is sort of designed to stop another collapse from that happening. So once you see that students are taking on tons of debt, but they're not actually earning money, it would stop those schools from taking on or from getting federal loans, which would essentially close the programs.
This was arguably the most significant piece of President Obama's higher education legacy. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. And so they're going to be halting that rule and renegotiating it. And we don't really know what their version of the rule will look like. That will take years to figure out. But for now, yeah, that Obama administration legacy is on its way out.
Okay. The second piece is the Borrower Defense to Repayment Plan. Quite a clumsy name there. But
yeah.
Betsy DeVos says that the Borrower Defense Rule is, quote, a muddled process that's unfair to students. What's this one about?
Yeah, so this is, again, relates a lot to for-profit college students. Basically, if students have been defrauded by their school, so if they're misled into taking out student loans, if they're told they're going to get job services and they don't, this rule would design a process by which they can apply to have their loans forgiven. And in fact, tens of thousands of students have already done this, or 16,000, I think. And this would sort of expedite that process, make sure that, you know, when loans are forgiven, the schools, it's not just the taxpayers who are on the hook for paying for this. Those rules, a lot of colleges were not super happy with those rules because they didn't just apply to for-profits. They also applied to nonprofits as well.
It also includes provisions to prevent colleges from forcing their students to sign away their right to sue later on. Isn't that right?
Yeah, the mandatory arbitration clauses, which is part of the reason these for-profit colleges got so big, because their students had signed these agreements and they weren't able to join class action lawsuits and make all this information public, hold these schools accountable when they were sort of cheated, as they said.
So Betsy DeVos says these rules have put taxpayers on the hook for significant costs and that that's unfair. Give us the broader reason here for these rollbacks.
It's actually not completely clear. I mean, I think that Republicans have sort of long said that they are government overreach, particularly with gainful employment, that the government shouldn't sort of be distinguishing between for-profit colleges, nonprofit colleges, and that's what it unfairly targets the for-profit college industry. So a lot of people see this as kind of, easing the burden on the for-profit college industry that the Obama administration put, and that in fact caused a lot of for-profit colleges to go out of business during the Obama years.
Mm. So you said these rules will be renegotiated? Is that what you said?
Yes.
They won't vanish altogether? What kind of impact does that have on students in the interim?
In the interim, it's actually not completely clear whether the Education Department is going to continue, enforcing every part of these rules until they get the new rules in place. What it probably means is that if you're a student looking to enroll in a school, it's good to be a little bit more wary. You can't just trust that, had this school been failing these metrics, that they wouldn't be able to access federal money. So I would say, exercise more caution. And if you're a student who has been defrauded by your schools, it probably is going to be a tougher process to get loan forgiveness. But again, we don't quite know because this just happened last week and we're not exactly sure what shape the new rules will take.
So help us understand Molly Hensley-Clancy, Betsy DeVos's new education budget. I'm reading here plans to cut up to $10 billion from federal education initiatives. Is that true?
Yep.
And what will go?
A lot of stuff will go. Basically everything, or not everything, but a lot of things besides these school choice initiatives that have been sort of Betsy DeVos's pet project, a lot of that is going to be facing. So a lot of grant programs will be cut. A lot of programs for subsidized federal student loans. There's a whole new sort of loan regime that it's proposing that will probably be a lot tougher on graduate students in terms of getting relief and forgiveness for them. And then we have the $10 billion cuts and then about $1 billion that are being added or reappropriated to school choice initiatives.
Right. So talk about that. $1 billion to push public schools to adopt choice-friendly policies. What does that mean?
That basically means expanding charter schools, allowing students to choose where they're going to school rather than just sort of, they have their district school and that's where you show up. And there's also this notion of a voucher program, which we're not really sure what it will take. But private school vouchers are a big, a pet project of Betsy DeVos's again. So there's $250 million that should go or would go in some form to a voucher program so students can use public money to attend private schools.
So bottom line here, she wants to shrink the federal government's role in education, also public school education, and give parents more options, I guess, is what she would say.
Yeah, I think Betsy DeVos thinks that choice is basically the solution to the problems in American education, that if parents are empowered to choose whatever type of school that their student attends, whether that's like an online school, that's going to be the thing that is going to fix a lot of the problems in inequity and all this other stuff that American education is facing. So she's focused on increasing choice and cutting out everything else that she can.
You have written about this what you call a fragile bipartisan alliance that's formed around the charter school movement.
Yeah.
Democrats have been willing to cross the aisle, if you will, to align with Republicans on charter school policies. Talk about how these changes might affect that working relationship.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it does come down to vouchers. You know, whenever Betsy DeVos was at a charter school conference last week, and when she talked about how great charter schools were, in the same breath, she was talking about how great vouchers are. And while people do agree that charters generally agree on the fact that charters really help students, it's a lot more questionable, you know, whether vouchers actually help. And it gets into these sort of thorny issues of a separation of church and state, since most private schools are religious schools. And I think that's made a lot of charter advocates, many of whom are Democrats, very nervous. They also, a lot of their students are Black and Latino, low income, and, you know, have not necessarily embraced the Trump administration. So I think that I talk to a lot of charter leaders who are feeling pressure to push back against the Trump administration, even though they're pushing for these pro-charter policies. It's sort of a tough line to walk, and a lot of them are saying that they're siding, you know, they're willing to sort of take a stand against Trump, even though these policies may help their schools individually.
So the vouchers are a step too far for the charter school coalition, bottom line.
Yes, and even for a lot of Republicans, in fact, are skeptical of vouchers as well, you know, Republicans in rural states particularly.
So a lot of big changes you've outlined here. There are others that we'll get mm-hmm. to throughout the hour. But, I mean, this changes the landscape pretty dramatically. Does it not? Is that fair to say?
It certainly has the potential to do that. I think it's still early days, but I think that certainly things are going to be very different than they were under the Obama administration in both higher education and elementary and secondary education.
Remind us why Betsy DeVos, Secretary DeVos, has been such a polarizing figure in the midst of all of these changes. She's taken the heat for a lot of it.
Yeah, she absolutely has. I mean, since basically the day of her confirmation hearing, which was quite rocky, she's been sort of this this political, you know, the center of this political fight. And she said some very controversial things that really rankled Democrats. And, you know, a lot of she was actually the first time that a vice president had to step in and break a tie on a confirmation because two Republicans voted against her. So she really, you know, from the very beginning, a lot of people have been very skeptical of her. She doesn't have a ton of experience in government. She was a big Republican donor for a long time. And yeah, you know, everyone will remember the line from her confirmation where she talked about sort of, you know, having gun control in schools in order to protect against grizzly bears. She went viral. And since then, it's been it's been sort of tough for her.
So 20 seconds before the break here, Molly, give us a timetable for when Congress reviews this budget, reviews these changes. Where does it go from here?
Well, the budget itself is probably, as many Republicans say, dead on arrival. But the changes, you know, in the next, it's going to take a few years for some of these changes to go into effect.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking this hour at the future of the American education system under the new headmaster, Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. And you can join the conversation. Are these the kind of bold moves you were hoping to see? Does this scare you to death? During her January confirmation hearing, then Secretary of Education nominee, Betsy DeVos, spoke about giving parents options about their children's schools.
Parents no longer believe that a one-size-fits-all model of learning meets the need of every child, and they know other options exist, whether magnet, virtual, charter, home, faith-based, or any other combination.
And during a May 24th hearing before the House Appropriations Subcommittee, Massachusetts Democratic Representative Catherine Clark asked Education Secretary Betsy DeVos whether charter schools that refuse to admit students from certain backgrounds would receive federal funding.
You are the backstop for students in their right to access a quality education. Would you, in this case, say, we are going to overrule and you cannot discriminate, whether it be on sexual orientation, race, special needs, in our voucher programs. Will that be a guarantee from you for our students?
For states who have programs that allow for parents to make choices, they set up the rules around that.
So that's a no.
We're speaking this hour with Molly Hensley Clancy from BuzzFeed News, and joining me now from Washington, Carmel Martin, Executive Vice President for Policy at the Center for American Progress. She was the Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development at the Department of Education under President Obama. Carmel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me from via Skype from Chartres, France, is Max Eden, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, where his expertise is in early education, school choice, and federal education policy. Max, welcome to you as well. Great to have you.
Yeah, great to be here, Jen.
So, Carmel, I'll start with you. How would you grade the performance of Betsy DeVos since she's been sworn in as the education secretary?
I would definitely give her an F. I think on every, if you look at every major area of responsibility under her, the Department of Education, she's going in the wrong direction in terms of supporting and protecting the public education system. In terms of the K-12 education system, she's been very clear that she's not an advocate for it, but an adversary in pushing to move money from that system into private schools where there's no accountability and no civil rights protections for students. Her budget has dramatic cuts, as Molly mentioned in the last segment, almost $10 billion in cuts, 14% on an annual basis. In terms of higher education, where the funding isn't an annual allocation, but if the changes were made that Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump have proposed, students would lose over $140 billion over 10 years through losses in terms of loan subsidies and federal grants. Just this morning, they released the New York Times reported that they sent a letter to the Office of Civil Rights asking them to scale back their investigations in terms of civil rights, ensuring protection of students' civil rights. Mm-hmm. So on all of these fronts, you see her going in the absolutely wrong direction.
So Max Eden, how do you see it? Secretary DeVos says it's time for a, quote, regulatory reset. How do you view her work so far?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with her and kind of evaluate her a little bit differently than Carmel. I'd give her, at this point, a B for rolling back a lot of the overreach of the Obama administration, both in terms of policy proper and in terms of overly aggressive attempts to make policy from a handful of folks in D.C. and defer things back to state and local leaders, erase some of the Obama administration's particularly egregious regulations. And so for all that stuff, I think that she is doing very well. The question, of course, is what comes next in a lot of these cases. You were talking about gainful employment, defense direct payment. I think rolling back both of those regulations due to their severe flaws is a step in the right direction, but ultimately the proof will be in what comes to replace them, and I think it's a little bit too soon to tell on that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We mentioned the gainful employment mandate, the borrower defense to repayment changes to those acts. Max Eden, Secretary DeVos says taxpayers should not be held responsible for bad loans, for sour loans that have come out of these for-profit institutions, that's a student's responsibility, not the government's. What do you say to that? Do you agree?
Well, I would say the question really on gainful employment is one of quality control and how we try to evaluate quality in our higher education system, right? We give loans to any student for any program for any price, and as a result, we have many students making subsidized bad decisions that lead to financial ruin. So how do we fix that? One notion that the Obama administration put forward, which is a very reasonable notion, is let's evaluate these programs by the ratio of debt that the students take on to earnings that they later go on to have,
mm-hmm.
Which is reasonable. But why would that be only targeted towards for-profit colleges? There are also very bad nonprofit colleges, very bad community colleges. And so I think part of the question is, as the Trump administration tries to rethink our approach to higher education policy, if there's an idea that has some promise, why would we target it only to one relatively small sector?
Mm. Carmel, Martin, jump in here. I mean, the eight attorneys general say they will sue the Department of Education over some of these recent changes, these proposed rollbacks. How will these changes affect the average student, do you think?
Well, I think it'd be extremely damaging to many, many students. I think to respond to Max's point, I would say I think there is more that can be done to ensure quality across all post-secondary institutions. But to answer his question, why these set of institutions is we if you look at every measure of quality with respect to post-secondary institutions, these for-profit institutions fail in every measure as a cohort, and are the rates of failure are much, much higher than in the nonprofit sector. Just to give an example, is among the for-profit colleges, if you measure how many students are able to pay just $1 back of their debt within 3 years after graduation, among this cohort of institutions, the rate is 48%. When you compare that to nonprofits, 73%. So there's a bigger problem in this sector. We also have lots and lots of evidence of predatory practices where these institutions are looking to make money, not to help students be successful. They pour tons of money into recruitment efforts so that they can get low-income students into their programs attached with their federal aid. And most of the money is coming from taxpayer dollars, not the families, taxpayer dollars in the form of loans and grant programs. So there was a clear problem with the systemic problem within this sector, and the Obama administration tackled it through very reasonable quality control measures. We can have a debate about whether we should expand those quality control measures outside of this sector, but the federal statute gave them the authority to do it with respect to this sector.
We should remember that President Trump ran a for-profit school, Trump University, now defunct, for which he paid $25 million to settle a class action lawsuit that alleged fraud. Molly Hensley Clancy, jump back in here. Have other students from other universities received settlements to this larger point?
Have they received defense to repayment settlements?
Yes.
So there's a group of students at this school that I mentioned, Corinthian Colleges. There's one other for-profit where students have actually been promised by the Department of Education that they will be receiving loan forgiveness. And they haven't yet seen that. A deadline passed, and the DeVos administration has still not yet given the forgiveness that those students were promised. So, I mean, you do have that dynamic going on as well. I did also want to mention that the idea of taxpayer dollars, that the defense to repayment regulation puts those at risk. There's actually provisions in the regulation that are meant to sort of stop that from happening. There's financial rules where if you have a lot of these claims against you, if you look like you're in a financially risky position, the department, per these regulations, will ask you to post a letter of credit that would prove that you're able to make these payments, to not just go out of business and leave taxpayers on the hook. So there are some provisions that are meant to stop taxpayers. You can debate about whether those are effective or not, but there is some backstop there that's supposed to help.
Which those provisions, this is Carmel, sorry to interrupt, those provisions have now been suspended by Betsy DeVos, so it's a little bit hypocritical for her to say that taxpayers shouldn't bear the brunt when she undoes the provision that would ensure that taxpayers wouldn't need to. It's these institutions who should bear the brunt of this. 68,000 students are awaiting relief under the provision that Molly just mentioned.
Max Eden, how do you respond to that point?
Yeah, so I think it goes back to the question of the details of what will come out of it. Per Carmel's earlier point, it is absolutely true that poor quality, while it is rampant across sectors, is particularly concentrated in the for-profit colleges. And so if all that Betsy DeVos does on the gainful employment regs is repeal them and not replace them, then I would rather be of the same mind as Carmel that it's a step back. But if what she does instead is repeal them and expand them or modify them in a way that goes towards the effort to regulate the sector more effectively, then I think it's one step back, two steps forward. Mm-hmm. On the defense to repayment stuff, the question is really in the particulars. The wording of the liability for colleges for the taxpayer on this was that if there is a substantial misrepresentation, a student could seek relief. What is a substantial misrepresentation? It's a statement or omission with a tendency to mislead under the circumstances, which is about clear as mud. So my bigger worry on this was not that Trump would repeal it, but rather that he would use it as a way to kind of go Henry VIII on American colleges and universities by colluding with outside groups to make the colleges on the hook for students that, under most definitions, they wouldn't really have lied to, but folks in the Department of Education, who are the sole adjudicators of this, decide that they have it out for UMassouri or Swarthmore or any others.
Let me get some listeners in here. I got a lot on the board. First is Stephanie in Boston. Hi, Stephanie. Glad you called. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
You
I'm speaking to the school choice issue.
Okay.
It would work lovely. Vouchers and charter schools and magnet schools, everything like that works well in a place like Boston or the greater Metro West area where you actually have options. I taught for years in a very rural county in Washington State, and our school was the school. In places like that, there are not options, and I do not think that the secretary is considering rural areas where literally these kids, if they had a choice, would have to be bused 2.5 hours to Spokane, which is the nearest area, or 4 hours to Seattle. There isn't an option for these kids, and there's no tax base there, or very small tax base. So they would be defunding a place that relies on federal and state dollars anyway, and sending these kids supposedly into this nebulous world of, you know, maybe like a boarding school or something. That would be their choice because the school that is there is the school.
It's a great point, Stephanie. Thank you very much. Molly Hensley Clancy, I'll bring you back in here. She makes an excellent point. What about these rural areas where they don't have options, where a big segment of the American student population is really out of the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that is an incredibly important point, especially when you think about the people that elected President Trump. I think that you do see actually several or quite a few rural Republicans who are very wary of school choice and wary of vouchers for that reason. One of the things that Betsy DeVos has talked about is the idea of virtual charter schools. She mentions them quite a lot. That's essentially an option where a student can go to school online. It's kind of a form of homeschooling, but it's funded by public dollars. A lot of people are very worried about her mentioning that because generally virtual schools do not have great results. There have been some recent studies and pretty consistently have shown that virtual schools are failing to help students learn. And I think that, you know, so that option that Betsy DeVos has proposed has a lot of people worried. But that is one way that students could sort of participate in this school choice ecosystem, despite being so far away.
Stephanie, thanks so much for the call. Max Eden, to the broader question of school choice and school choice options, you know, many people say that using public funds to support school choice undermines the traditional public school systems, which educate the majority of American kids, 80% of American kids. What's your response to that in the context of what Betsy DeVos is doing, what she's proposing?
Yeah, I would say that the American tradition of education is that we absolutely must make a provision for all students and make extra provision for those who are the poorest and need the most. But the exact method of that is not something that's been quite set in stone from the founding. And so there is, however, a big limitation towards what she can do towards that from the federal level, right? Because there's kind of the intuition that school choice people hold is that choice works because families and local communities make these decisions for themselves. And so there's a lot of overlap between the pro-school choice folks and the pro-local control folks. And so when you have a Secretary of Education who, on the one hand, pays homage to the virtues of local control, and on the other hand, says that she wants to expand school choice, there is a certain tension there, and it's hard to imagine in some instances how she will kind of navigate that effectively.
Carmel Martin, you know, the parents, a lot of them say, I have the right to choose where my kid goes to school. Our public school is failing. It's not good. Public schools should be run like businesses. They should be subject to competition, to closure if they're not performing. Why isn't Betsy DeVos right on this point?
Well, those things you just described are not true about most private schools. They should be true with respect to charter schools, and I personally and CAP are supporters of public school choice, including high quality public charter. I would say that there's a obvious distinction between public charter schools and for-profit charters or private schools in that there's accountability with respect to the public school charter schools. They can be closed if they're not performing well, at least where that's how it should be in a well-functioning system. And they also are protected under the civil rights laws. There's an ability to ensure that no children are being discriminated against. Those protections don't exist in private schools. And to the caller's point about this this really being a false debate for most Americans. We did a report in March that showed that of the 15,000 school districts in America, in 9,000 of them, they're what we would call sparse school districts, where there's four or fewer schools in the entire school district. So just really backing up the caller's point that most of America, this idea of having a private school choice option is kind of a red herring, because that's not their lived experience.
Thank you for that. Let me get Michael in here before we go to break in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Not much time. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How are you? I'm in favor of generally anything that reduces the federal government involvement into education, even going so far as to support the elimination of the Department of Education and returning all decisions on education back to the state level.
Michael, thank you. Molly, I'm not sure Secretary DeVos is going that far. Is she not? She's not proposing that, is she?
She's not, although she did have an interview early on where she said she was going to essentially work to eliminate her own job or work on it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking this hour at Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos and her vision, her new vision for America's schools. You can join the conversation. Do you support DeVos's efforts to scale back civil rights protections for students? What are the lessons she's teaching? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. During her confirmation hearing on January 17th, Betsy DeVos was asked about whether or not she would push states to use school vouchers. Here is her answer.
No, I would hope I could convince you all of the merit of that in maybe some future legislation, but certainly not any kind of mandate from within the department.
We're speaking this hour with Molly Hensley Clancy from BuzzFeed News, Carmel Martin at the Center for American Progress, and Max Eden at the Manhattan Institute. A lot of listener response here. Let's get a couple in. Chris says, DeVos's vision is to take public school education dollars for the poor and redistribute to so-called charter schools for middle-class evangelists. It's despicable and a guarantee that the dumbing down of the populace accelerates. Luna says, DeVos's vision is to destroy public education in favor of deregulation for profit, charter, and voucher schools. Let's get Lisa in here from Austin, Texas. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a couple of points that deal with disabled students and her plan for vouchers. So school choice isn't a school choice unless it applies for all students. And disabled students are not accepted in private schools because private schools can discriminate against whoever they want for whatever reason they want. And typically in states that do have voucher programs, parents have to sign away IDEA law protections, which is federal law. It's not up to the states. And third, the free market doesn't typically accommodate disabled students because they're not lucrative to educate. So the data in voucher states has proven that disabled students do not benefit. It is, in my opinion, state-sanctioned segregation, and we should not be cutting into the budget for special education to benefit those who are not disabled. Our disabled students are vulnerable enough. They do not need more challenges to their educational civil rights.
Got it, Lisa. Thank you very much for the call. Molly, jump in here. What about disabled students, special needs, special ed in the proposals of Betsy DeVos?
Yeah, I mean, we just don't quite know exactly what this voucher program that DeVos has envisioned will take, whether it's a tax credit and what kind of rules that schools will be required to follow. Generally, if you're getting federal money, you have to follow federal law, and that would include IDEA. But like I said, it's sort of up in the air what exactly that's going to look like in terms of both student civil rights at these schools getting vouchers and also in terms of disabled students. But it's certainly something that people have been very worried about. Early in her confirmation hearings, Betsy DeVos seemed to not know whether or not IDEA was a federal law, and that already sort of started people very nervous from the very beginning.
Speaking of rights for students, a few months ago, the Education Department rescinded guidelines for protections of transgender and gay students. Molly, speak to that. Some reported that Betsy DeVos wanted to keep those guidelines but lost the battle here. How did that play out?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say what went on behind the scenes, but that certainly was a narrative that I and a lot of other people were hearing, that she did not want to take back these guidelines. Jeff Sessions did. When they ended up rescinding the guidelines, which again would allow transgender students to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity, Secretary DeVos said, you know, we're going to come out with some new guidelines to protect transgender students, which they did last week. And it's unclear exactly. Some advocates are nervous about those guidelines that they issued. They don't specifically mention bathroom rights, which is obviously a huge issue for the transgender community. They focus more on bullying by individual students. Mm-hmm. So certainly people are very nervous about that.
Max Eden, do you worry that Secretary DeVos will abandon protections for some of these students?
Not particularly. I think that she's going back to the role for the Office of Civil Rights, which is primarily about defending students' rights who allege that they've been offended. And the Obama administration took that office and turned it into kind of an offensive role where wherever they saw a social phenomenon that troubled them, they used the office in order to go down to school districts, go to colleges and universities, and say, because we interpret these few words of a statute written 40 years ago differently, therefore you have to change your policy. So I think that the Trump administration, DeVos, taking a step back from that is a step in the right direction, and I'm not concerned that she will not enforce students' rights. I think she'll rather actually restore the Office of Civil Rights to one that tries to defend students' rights rather than one that tries to change educational policy across the country.
Jane, if I could jump
Carmel,
in
Carmel, what is your stand on this?
Yeah, I think what the Obama administration did was tackle problems in terms of students across America, their rights being trampled on. I think in terms of, for example, their interpretation of Title IX to protect women on college campuses from sexual assault. That is a documented problem across the institutions in America, and the Obama administration was aggressive in terms of tackling it, but rightly so. Their job was to ensure that women's rights under Title IX are protected, that LGBT individuals' rights are protected, that students with disabilities' rights are protected. So I think it's wrong to say that they were just trying to find things to do. There were big problems in all these areas, and they tackled them because it was their job to do it. What we see Betsy DeVos doing is the exact opposite. She's calling for cuts to the Office of Civil Rights budget, so they'll have to make staffing changes that will reduce their ability to protect students' rights. The LGBT guidance does not speak to access to facilities such as bathrooms, so it leaves institutions with the implication that they don't have to protect LGBT students in that context. So I think, again, it's not that the Obama administration was overly aggressive and somehow the Trump administration's getting an equal balance here. They are very clearly moving in the opposite direction and saying that it's not their role to protect students' civil rights, which it is legally their job to do.
Let me get some more voices from our callers here. Jonathan in Vermilion, South Dakota. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Well, I guess I'm concerned a lot about the talk of, you know, budget cuts and taking funding and putting it more in the hands of state. Being in South Dakota, being a university professor, South Dakota is already one of the lowest funded states for education and public education. And to, you know, deregulate it in a way and let states control it just seems to me that for a lot of states where education is not necessarily important, you know, South Dakota is a very agriculture heavy state, that a lot of programs and a lot of schools may be in trouble, especially, you know, arts and sciences that do not necessarily fall into the normal mode of being funded.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, thanks for the point and the call. Molly, speak to that. What does moving towards state control for education do to states that don't put a lot of money into education?
I mean, I think it a lot of state money already, most money in education does already come from the states. The federal government doesn't have a ton of control. I think it's less about the money and more about sort of what priorities are states going to put on various programs. And I mean, I think that this goes back to the civil rights issue too, because once you let sort of states have, you know, more say in what kinds of things they investigate and whether or not they focus on bathroom rights, you again are going to get this sort of separation where you have some states that are focusing on school choice that are giving giving money to voucher programs and other states that are taking sort of opposite tack. So it's probably going to lead to sort of more of a diversification. But like I said, a lot of the vast majority of money in education right now already does come from the states.
Here's from, let's see, January 17th, this is a confirmation hearing of Betsy DeVos. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren grilled then Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos about her experience with student loans.
Mrs. DeVos, have you ever taken out a student loan from the federal government to help pay for college?
I have not.
Have any of your children had to borrow money in order to go to college?
They have been fortunate not to.
Uh-huh. Have you had any personal experience with a Pell Grant?
Not personal experience, but certainly friends and students with whom I've worked.
So you have no personal experience with college financial aid or management of higher education.
And here's Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin earlier this month criticizing Betsy DeVos during a Senate Appropriations Committee hearing, claiming that her department's budget does not reflect the concerns she says she has for student loan borrowers.
Your budget increases the interest burden of students. Your budget freezes the Pell Grant so they have to borrow more. Your budget doesn't give them public loan forgiveness.
The budget actually gives students a really well-defined and new way to address their student loans long-term, their student debt long-term through income-driven repayment plan that would cap the repayment at 12.5% of their discretionary income, and after 15 years for undergraduates would be paid off.
Secretary DeVos is seeking to overhaul key elements of federal financial aid, Molly Hensley-Clancy. What would this mean for Pell Grants? We heard that mentioned here, for Perkins loans for disadvantaged students. What does all that mean for this category of student?
Well, Pell Grants are probably going to remain funded. And in fact, the budget calls to have allow for Pell Grants year-round, which is something that advocates have long been pushing for, so that students can catch up on classes and study in the summer. Right now, you can't use your Pell Grant year-round. I think the question of how disadvantaged students are going to be affected by this new plan, it is true that, in fact, you pay a larger portion of your income, but you get your loans forgiven faster. And it's not totally clear. For some students, that's going to be really helpful. For other students, the increased loan burden is going to make it a lot tougher, and then the forgiveness isn't going to come soon enough. The one thing we do know that is that these new loan programs for graduate students are probably going to be a lot, are going to increase the burden. They're not going to get their loans forgiven for 30 years as opposed to 25 now. So graduate students are definitely going to be hit if this loan provision does pass.
So Max Eden, how do you see this, the loan programs under Secretary DeVos?
Yeah, I see that as maybe the brightest part of her current agenda, right? Going to your point about the graduate student loans, I think most Americans might feel as though it's kind of unjust for poor middle-class taxpayers to pay for the law degree of somebody who could go to a six-figure firm and decides to go to a high five-figure public interest firm instead. And so the Trump administration has said, we will no longer forgive large-scale loans for those who go into public service. You'll have to pay your own way. If you can afford to get into grad school, you can probably afford to pay for it in the back end. Or if you're not going to get forgiven, it's going to be over the course of 30 years before that, which means you're probably going to end up paying for it. So those who can pay for themselves should pay for themselves. And those from more disadvantaged backgrounds will see forgiveness a few years earlier than under Obama's plan. It'll go from 20 years to 15 years. And so if you're not making a significant amount of money, you're not making your dues, you're out of limbo a little bit sooner. And if you're making a reasonable amount of money and college is kind of paying off, maybe not as much, you're going to see a little bit forgiven. So I think that that's a kind of a very positive redistribution from those with higher economic prospects to those who might be struggling after college.
Positive redistribution, Carmel Martin, sounds reasonable?
No, I don't think it sounds reasonable. The big law firm, people graduating going to big law firms don't benefit from these programs because they can pay well above 12% of their income to be able to cover their loans. So they're not the people who are benefiting from
these
programs.
So it's the low-income students who benefit.
Well, it was the people who are going to become public defenders and making very little money, making, you know, having hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt from law school, but going to help low-income people in the legal profession. And those are the people who are benefiting from these programs. They also increase the monthly payment for undergraduate students from 10 to 12.5%, which might not sound a lot, but for students struggling to pay back their debt, that's a lot of money in a budget that has $1 trillion for billionaires and corporate interests. So this isn't a budget that shaves money here to give it back to somebody else there. This is a budget that cuts $10 billion from the Department of Education, but has $1 trillion over 10 years for people like Donald Trump. So I think people have to put these budget cuts in context. Overall, this budget would cut $143 billion over 10 years from college student aid, and the same budget would give $1 trillion to corporate interest and high wealth families and individuals.
Let me get Jude in here from Holiday, Florida. Hi, Jude. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I'll just be brief. I have $141,000 in student debt.
Oh,
I'm a grad student with a 3.9 GPA. I'm about to get my first master's degree, and I have to roll right into my second master's degree because I never used my print advertising bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see under Betsy DeVos? What's the way forward for you with some of these new proposals?
Well, they just took away the grad student $55,000 max aggregate of the unsub loans. I mean, of the subsidized loans, so we can't even get that anymore. We can only get unsubsidized loans. So I finally found what I wanted to do, which is a clinical psychologist, which is the next master's program I'm going into, and I'm reaching my max aggregate. So with all of this going on, I'm going to have to pay out of pocket, and I can't even pay my loans back. That's the whole reason why I'm in school still.
Mm-hmm. Jude, thank you. Max Eden, we're running out of time here, but Jude, there he is, grad student, $141,000 in debt, can't take advantage of some of these proposals that he thought would help him. What would you say to him?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the fundamental role of the federal government of education is to help those who don't have the means to access an education to be able to access one. And when you get into the territory where you're going on your second master's degree and trying to make those decisions in that manner, you've made them for yourselves, and you shouldn't have the expectation that other taxpayers will pick up the dime for it.
Molly Hensley Clancy, take us out here. What do you expect to see from Betsy DeVos moving forward with regard to school choice, low-income students, civil rights? Where do you see all this heading?
Well, we don't really know exactly what the voucher program is going to look like, whether it's going to be a tax credit. So we're all waiting to see that. And we also, you know, we don't know what these new rules for for-profit college students are going to look like. So that's going to be another thing that's up in the air. I think it's you know, she's laid a groundwork for what she wants, you know, this vision to look like. But we just don't know exactly how it's going to play out.
To be continued. Really great information today from a great panel. Molly Hensley Clancy at BuzzFeed, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Carmel Martin, Executive Vice President for Policy at the Center for American Progress. Carmel, thanks to you.
Thanks for including me.
And Max Eden, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Really appreciate your time, Max. Thank you.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.